Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called, How to Make Every Employee a 100%er. What if every employee came to work with a can-do attitude and gave everything, their all, with drive, ambition, and determination in clearly defined goals? Having a team of superstars like that could do wonders for anyone's bottom line, and that can happen. In this interview, you'll hear all about it from Mark Murphy, author of 100%ers. Challenge your employees to give it their all, and they'll give you even more. Mark says one of the keys to getting employees or getting yourself to become a 100%er is by making good attitudes and motivational goal setting top priorities. And in this audio, you'll hear the kind of strategies that may help you do that. You'll also learn and hear about real-life examples of what a 100%er looks like, what behavior traits they usually have, how they handle problems, and what exactly makes them such superstars. You'll hear about a simple strategy for getting employees to give you the exact roadmap they need to become a 100%er. Hint, it's not about having the answers, but about asking the right questions. You'll also learn strategies for inoculating yourself against difficult situations and difficult people, so you can take back control of your motivation and how to show others how to use their strategies too. You'll hear about the real problems with the SMART goals from the 1950s that so many organizations still use today to motivate employees, and how adding hard goals, heartfelt, animated, required, difficult, into the equation may be all you need to bring everyone up to 100%. You'll hear about the drastic move Mark says is necessary to turn around talented terrors, employees with great skills but lousy attitudes, and a word-for-word script you can take straight to that meeting. You'll hear about the biggest myths about making presentations and the single best way to connect with your audience and plant a message they won't forget right from your first sentence. Look, when it comes to 100%ers, Mark says it isn't about having super skills or extraordinary talent. It's about giving it the best effort possible with the best attitude. That's really what sets great employees apart from the rest of the bunch. And in this interview, you'll hear how to get that kind of effort from every employee and the amazing results that can follow once you do. Now let's get going.
Hi, this is Chris Costello, and I've teamed up with Michael Senoff to bring you the world's best health-related interviews. So if you know anyone struggling with their weight, with cancer, diabetes, ADHD, autism, heart disease, or other health issues, send them over to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Mark Murphy is founder and CEO of Leadership IQ, a top-rated research and consulting firm that delivers employee engagement and leadership development to the world's most successful organizations and their leaders. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great fun to be here.
So you've got a lot of really interesting information and a lot of things that seem very different from what people believe about leadership. But I want to start off with asking you about your new book, 100%ers. And what is a 100%er? And do you think that anybody can be one, or is that just somebody really special?
As a starting point, a 100%er is basically somebody who comes in every day and says, you know what, I'm going to give my best effort. Now, is everything going to work out perfectly every single day? No, but I'm going to be here with absolutely my best effort, and much of that represents, it generally turns into pretty good work product. Now, the interesting couple of things. Number one, right now, when we survey people across the country, only about 35% of employees right now say, yes, I feel inspired to give my best effort. So that's pretty bad. You know, there's 65% of the world is sitting out there saying, I don't really want to be 100%er. I'm not really driven to that right now. That's problem one, but the interesting thing is that while being a 100%er presumes some modicum of skill, that is, you have to cross some basic threshold, the major differentiator, the major thing that makes people really great performers in an organization is not so much that they've got super extraordinary skills that nobody's ever seen before, but rather it's the attitude that they bring. It's the giving that 100% effort. In fact, when you look at somebody like a Michael Jordan, the year that Michael Jordan was drafted, I think it was, forget the guy's first name, Bowie, was drafted ahead of Michael Jordan. There were people that looked at him and said, yeah, you know, he's got skill, no doubt about it, but there's other people with skill. What ultimately made Michael Jordan Michael Jordan wasn't the skill. Certainly they were excellent, but it was the drive. It was the fierce competitiveness. It was the attitude, basically, that turned him into what we now think of as Michael Jordan. And that's the same thing happens in the workplace. It's not that there's oftentimes somebody is going to be a better payables clerk than somebody else because we've got the natural skill to be a payables clerk. No, it's that somebody else takes that extra minute. They think through the work. They anticipate it. They build a relationship with all the other leaders in the organization. It's the attitudinal part that really sets them apart. The bad news is that we don't have nearly as many 100%ers as you'd like to see us have. The good news, however, is that being a 100%er is, by and large, a choice. Not we're born to it or not born to it. It's a choice that every one of us will make.
So how do we get to that point where we make that choice? You know, I know a lot of people, they start out in a job and they give 100%, and things happen where slowly that erodes. How do people stay at that 100%?
You know, it's interesting. And this has been our current research project about 2 years ago. We started to notice that there were a group of employees that seemed to be a little more immune to what their boss did or didn't do. So you take a normal organization. All right, so people kind of come in and their boss does whatever, and sometimes it's good and motivating and sometimes it's not so good. It's pretty demotivating. What we started to see was there was a group of employees that seemed more immune to that. It's like, yeah, you know, if my boss acts like a bit of a jerk, it's not going to destroy my day. That I still am going to be driven to be a 100%er. I'm still going to come in and say, yeah, you know what? I want to absolutely give 100% effort. I want to come in and knock it out of the park. And, you know, some days I'll have a really great boss and some days I'm going to have a not so great boss. And either way, that boss is only going to control so much of my motivation that ultimately a lot of this is really going to fall on my shoulders. And as we started to take a look at this, we noticed that the people who were 100%ers had certain behaviors that they exhibited that other people didn't exhibit. So, for example, they set goals that were very emotionally rich and challenging. That is, they gave themselves goals that they really cared about those goals. They could visualize these goals. They got emotionally excited about these goals, and they had to learn something. They were very challenging goals. And this seemed to provide sort of an inoculation against good bosses or bad bosses or, you know, a bad culture. As long as they felt driven towards something, they were much more resilient. Now, resilience was another characteristic and another set of behaviors that when things went wrong, these folks didn't just kind of sit passively back and say, oh, well, I guess that's it. The sky's falling now. They didn't catastrophize. When a bad situation happened, they looked at it and said, all right, well, first off, this isn't all bad. There's always something positive I can take from this. And secondly, if I get back on the horse and I go back after this, that's going to be the best antidote to this. They didn't kind of sit back when they got knocked with a tough blow. They didn't just sit back. They instantly were back on their feet and said, nope, I'm going to go back at it again. They also had very clear direction for their days. And one of our surveys, when we were determining if somebody was going to be 100% or not, we asked the question, do you start every day with a clear plan? And we found that the people who started every day with a clear plan were anywhere from 30 to 50% more motivated and more engaged than people who didn't start every day with a clear plan. And there were a host of behaviors like this that really separated people who were going to be 100%ers from the people that weren't going to be 100%ers. And the interesting thing was that when people started, people who weren't historically, you wouldn't have said, okay, this person's 100%er. Somebody who was historically kind of a, they did their job, they were fine, but they weren't anything exceptional. When they started to exhibit these behaviors, that is, when they started to set some robust goals, when they started to evidence more resilience, when they started to become more curious and open-minded, when they started to start every day with a clear plan, their motivation, their energy, their engagement started to go up. And this was the interesting thing. It wasn't just like, well, superstars do these behaviors and they're already a superstar, so doing the behavior or not doing it, not going to make a difference. No, what we found was that when these folks started to do these behaviors, it helped turn them into 100 percenters. So the long and short of it is that bosses obviously have an impact on our life, but they have much less of an impact for 100 percenters. One of the very first studies we did, we're looking at school teachers and looking at a couple of teachers in a pretty terrible district. The principal was awful. The school district was a mess. It was just bad. So there were two teachers in particular that caught my eye. And, you know, they're both working with the same terrible principal. One is still very motivated and saying, you know, every year I make a difference in these kids' lives. I have my plans and I'm not going to change the world, but I can change the lives of a couple of kids every year. And that drives me. That motivates me. And then there was another teacher who, the reason she caught my eye was she had just given notice that I can't take this anymore. It's just too bad. It's too depressing here. Nobody cares, blah, blah, blah. And they're working in the same exact environment. And they were the same age. They went to roughly the equivalent school. They started teaching at this school at the same time. It was sort of a perfect little controlled experiment. And when I looked at them, she had a much clearer sense of purpose. Every day, she didn't just let the day unfold. She directed how her day was going to unfold. When something bad happened, she was able to deal with it much more resiliently than the other teacher was. And when you looked at the teacher who was quitting, she did none of these behaviors. And that's sort of the classic test that if you exhibit the right behavior, you can inoculate yourself to even pretty difficult work environments and realize that ultimately you do, as an individual, have a lot of control over your own motivation and your engagement.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. And so the internal drive sounds like it's stronger than the outside circumstances for these people that are 100 percenters. Is that right, Mark?
Yes. And in essence, they have the technical term for it would be an internal locus of control. That is, they believe that they have control over their future, over their fate, over their destiny. They are the ones who control it. People with an external locus of control believe that it is the external world that drives whether or not they're going to be happy or successful. People with an internal locus of control say, listen, things are going to happen to me in the outside world, sure, but it is ultimately my choice as to what I do with it. If I am successful, it will be because I made myself successful. And if I fail, it will be because I failed. I'm not going to sit around and say the world has been harsh to me and the world hasn't given me and I haven't had the lucky breaks. No, it's on me. Whether I'm born to privilege or not born to privilege, I control my destiny. And having this internal locus of control, this belief that, yes, in fact, I do have a huge role to play in whether or not I achieve what I want to achieve, those people are the ones who tend to be much more inoculated against negative stuff out in the world, and they're much more immune to that. So they're more resilient, they're more engaged, they're more motivated, they're more goal-driven, and it's largely because they feel like my choices, my decisions ultimately drive my outcome.
And so, Mark, one of the things you talk about are the hard goals, and you have it on Leadership IQ as the science of extraordinary achievement. What do you consider hard goals, and why are they so important? Why do they make such a difference?
Great question. Goal setting is really a big piece of what drives success. So, you know, obviously, if we don't have great goals, we're not going to have great achievement. So a hard goal is basically a goal that it stands for four things. It is heartfelt, animated, required, and difficult. So what we discovered was that everybody has goals. And, you know, everybody sets New Year's resolutions and all of that good stuff. And yet, if you look at something like New Year's resolutions, 85% of New Year's resolutions are abandoned within 90 days of New Year's. All right, well, why? You know, we go through the trouble of setting these things. Why don't they work out? Well, there's a number of reasons. Number one is that we didn't really have a deep emotional attachment to it. You know, if you're emotionally attached to something, if you said, I'm going to quit smoking this year because I got a $10 coupon for a quit smoking drug or something, and you know, you can take it or leave it. You're not all that emotionally attached. But if all of a sudden you said, listen, the doctor said if I quit smoking, then I'll stay alive to get to my daughter's wedding next year. Okay, now the emotional attachment to that goal is going to be significantly higher. And one big reason that goals fail is we just can't answer the question, why do I care about this goal? You know, why do you want to lose 20 pounds? I don't know, doctor says I probably should, whatever. Well, no, that's not a deep enough caring to really get us to turn down the chocolate cake when we're out at that big party next week. We need to have a deeper emotional attachment to our goal than that. The animated piece. A lot of people, when you ask them, okay, well, what's this goal going to look like? What's the end result going to look like? What's it going to look like when you hit the end point here? They just can't picture it. They haven't really thought through the goal all that well. And this is another big factor. Animating goal basically means you've so clearly thought it through that you can absolutely visualize what this goal is going to look like, what it's going to look like at the very end. You know, we do an exercise sometimes with folks where, you know, if we're working with a CEO or an executive or something, we say, okay, well, let's imagine your ideal day at work. Imagine that Fortune magazine is coming to do an interview. And they're going to follow you around for the day. Walk me through, what does that ideal day actually look like? What are you doing? Who are you talking to? The person at the Starbucks, how are you interacting with them? What's your assistant saying to you when you walk in the door? Visualize it. Get a very clear picture of what that looks like. And the clearer that picture is, the more likely you are to be able to actually achieve that. But again, it comes back to, if you haven't thought through what the end point is, the odds that you're going to hit it are not that high. And then the R and the D, required and difficult, basically represent, the required is the question, why do I have to start this goal now? Like, what's my reason for urgency here? A lot of goals sound good, but they fall into the category of, I'll start it next week. Yeah, it's a perfectly lovely goal. I don't need to do it right today, but, you know, I'll get to it eventually. Because you might imagine, one of the big characteristics of people who achieve versus people who fail with their goals is that the people who succeed with their goals are the ones who say, no, I need to get going on this thing right here, right now. This isn't a wait for tomorrow kind of goal. I have to do something. You know, if I want to run a marathon, okay, I'm not going to go out and run a marathon today. It's a year from now, but I have to be able to do something today, even if I just do 50 squats or go walk around the parking lot for an hour. I got to do something today to get this going and build that urgency for this goal. And then finally, and this is really, I think, probably the most counterintuitive of all of this, is the notion that great goals are difficult. And there's 40 years of research that bears this out. But what we found in our own research is that when people have a goal that requires them to learn something, they get much more neurologically activated. That is, their brain really wakes up much more. They pay more attention. Now, we're all familiar with this concept. Whenever you hear somebody talk about a sports team, for example, that, oh, let's say, loses a game they should have won, and the commentators will say, well, they played down to the level of their competition. Turns out, that's not just for athletes. It's actually for all of us. Every one of us we'll play down to the level of our competition, or in this case, we'll play down to the level of our goal. And what we found is that when people set weak goals, it says something. It says this goal isn't that important. If I do it or don't do it, it doesn't really matter one way or the other. If it's a goal that your boss gave you, for example, and it's a really easy goal, basically you can interpret that as my boss doesn't think I'm capable of doing much more than this. My boss doesn't have much confidence in me. And you're going to sleepwalk through the goal. It's like driving to work every day. You know, we really don't pay all that much attention. We kind of sleepwalk through it. You know, we listen to our tunes. We kind of check out and all that. And we're really not highly engaged on the average commute into work. So when we look at this, a goal that requires you to actually pay attention, that wakes you up, that says, I'm going to have to actually learn something. I can't just kind of sleepwalk and do what I've always done if I'm actually going to achieve this goal. I'm actually going to have to really pay attention, really learn something. If you set a goal for an employee, for example, that says you're going to have to learn some new skills to achieve this goal, what it says to the employee is, I must really think you've got some talent. I must really think you've got some pretty great great attributes, because I wouldn't have given you a meaningful goal, a goal that's going to take some work to do, if I didn't think you were capable of it. So stretching ourselves, challenging ourselves is an absolutely critical part of having any great goal. And just kind of parenthetically, if you think about any great achievement you've ever had personally, any one of us, and if we ask ourselves, I mean, I don't care what the achievement is, you ran a marathon, you lost 20 pounds, you quit smoking, you got that big promotion, you put yourself through school, you started a company, you sold a company, whatever, it can be anything. When you think about that great achievement you've had in your life, the kind that sticks with you, where you're still proud of to this day, and then you ask yourself, was this great achievement easy or hard? Did I know everything, or did I have to learn new skills along the way? Was it a fait accompli, or did I have some doubt along the way? Was it inside my comfort zone, or was it outside my comfort zone? Generally, what you find is that every great goal outside your comfort zone, it was hard, it pushed you, you had to learn new skills, you had a little trepidation along the way. It has all of the elements of HARD, heartfelt, animated, required, and difficult, and that's really the kicker. Your goal isn't waking you up, getting you excited, driving you forward, then it's just not going to achieve great things. And if it doesn't look like the kinds of goals that you've had in your life that have made you amazingly successful, it's just simply not going to work that well.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. And Mark, another thing you talk about are SMART goals. And what are those, and what are some of the disadvantages of only relying on SMART goals, and if you need to, turn them into hard goals?
Yeah, great question. This is one that is a very big issue in most organizations. A SMART goal is kind of the traditional goal-setting methodology for a lot of organizations. It was created in the 1950s, and it basically stands for specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-limited. Some of those pieces are perfectly good. You know, who doesn't want a goal that's specific? Who doesn't want a goal that isn't a, we're going to do this forever, but actually has a time limit on it? All that stuff is great stuff. But the problem with SMART goals comes in when we start to take a look at the achievable, realistic piece of it. So what we discovered in doing some research on this is that when you ask people who have SMART goals, is this goal for this year, if you're using a SMART goal, is this goal going to help you achieve great things? Only 15% of employees say, yes, absolutely, my SMART goal is going to help me achieve great things. If you ask them, is this goal going to help you maximize your full potential? Only about 13% of employees say, yeah, the SMART goal is going to help me maximize my full potential. The issue basically comes up that it's the achievable and realistic thing that tends to get in people's way. Because when SMART goals were created, it was a goal-setting methodology created, as I said, in the 1950s, and created in a command-and-control kind of environment. So you think back to the 1950s, you know, it was the era of the man in the gray flannel suit. It was giant conglomerates. Everybody sit in their box, you know, don't move too far, don't color outside the line. Innovation wasn't really the buzzword that it is today. It was more, no, stick to your knitting. You know, we had a general as our president, Eisenhower. Not that it was a bad era. It was just a very different era than what we have today. And so SMART goals are very much a product of their time. Whereas in today's world, we're less concerned about having people, you know, making sure they color inside the lines. We're more concerned with getting them to push, to get creative. You know, this is where we think about every cool thing we've had in the past 10 years. You know, iPhones, iPads, Google, Starbucks, take your pick. All of it is the result of somebody saying, yeah, I know this isn't the norm, but let's push outside the norm anyway. Let's get kind of funky. This is where the SMART goals go wrong. So what we found is that if you just take achievable, realistic part of SMART goals and instead say, okay, I want a goal that is specific, measurable, and time-limited. That's all good. But now, take that hard goals idea. You don't have to put it on a special form or anything, but rather, just say, I'm going to take those SMART goal concepts and make sure that instead of making sure that my goal is totally achievable and realistic, I'm just going to rewrite that a little bit, and I'm going to make sure that it's actually pushing me a little bit. I'm still going to keep it specific, measurable, and time-limited, but I'm going to make sure it's pushing me a little bit. I'm going to certainly make sure that I have some heartfelt, emotional attachment to this goal. I'm going to make sure that I have a sense of urgency, that it's required, and then I'm going to make sure that it is animated, that I can actually clearly picture these goals. So what we found is that hard goals are not necessarily in conflict with SMART goals. They are kind of, but you can make them not be in conflict. Basically, if you make a little tweak to your SMART goals, you can keep the bulk of the SMART goal idea, but instead infuse the goal with these four big questions. Why do I care about it? What's my heartfelt attachment? What does it look like? Can I picture it? That's my animated. Why do I have to do and what can I do right today to get started with it? That's the required piece. And then the difficulty, what am I going to have to learn to achieve this goal? With a few tweaks, you can kind of undo a lot of the badness that exists with a lot of our current goal-setting methodologies and still end up in pretty good shape.
And one of the things you talk about, and I love the title, is talented terrors in organizations. Employees with great skills but lousy attitudes. Everybody knows they can be very destructive to leadership in the workplace. So what can leaders do to kind of turn the talented terrors into valuable people?
This is always one of the big issues that leaders face. It kind of begins with the idea of recognizing that talented terrors exist, which kind of goes back to the very beginning of our discussion about this notion that attitude plays a big part in determining success or failure. That you can have great skill, but if you're a jerk about it, it's not going to turn into great performance. And so the thing we all have to think about is high performers are basically people with both great skills and great attitude. And one of the very first things that we have to do is make sure that our folks understand that I'm not going to give you the big giant trophy for having great skills but having a lousy attitude. You've actually got to have a great attitude to go with those great skills. And one of the reasons talented terrors exist is that too many people say, oh, well, you know, they're a high performer. They just got kind of a lousy attitude. No, there's no such thing as being a high performer with a lousy attitude. That's a low performer. High performers have both great skills and great attitude. So first thing we have to do is basically get rid of phrases like they're a high performer with just a bad attitude. And once we start to say, listen, you have to have a great attitude, then we as leaders have now kind of established a platform for ourselves whereby we can just come right out and say, listen, you want to succeed in this organization? People with bad attitudes are not going to get 5 out of 5 in their next performance review. That's not the way it works. We're actually going to include attitude and the associated behaviors in our performance reviews. I'm going to sit down and have a conversation with somebody with a bad attitude. And that by itself is a skill that leaders have to learn. A lot of leaders are sadly kind of unprepared for dealing with talented terrors simply because talented terrors are not stupid. They're talented terrors, not dumb terrors. So they're very verbally adroit, but also they have pretty forceful personality. So it's a conversation dealing with a talented terror that a leader is going to have to prepare themselves for. It's going to be a very scripted conversation. It's not going to be an exploration of where this person came from in their childhood and why they didn't get enough hugs and et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be a very clear delineation that says, listen, I've called you in today to talk about your performance and the news isn't so good. Right now, you're exhibiting the following behaviors. And these behaviors, and they're usually attitudinal in nature, these behaviors, poor customer service, arrogance with the team members, whatever it is, these behaviors are unacceptable. Now, I believe you can change those behaviors. I believe that you are more than capable of altering those behaviors and becoming a true high performer. But I need to make crystal clear that these behaviors are not going to be allowed to continue. So you can decide if you want to make that change, or you can decide if you don't want to make that change. And if you don't want to make that change, that's fine. We're just going to have a separate conversation, you and I, where we're going to talk about everything up to and including termination. And if you decide you do want to make that change, then I would be thrilled to sit down and work with you and outline exactly what behaviors need to change. And the conversation is generally that simple, but it is delivered in a very, not aggressive, but assertive manner. It's very matter of fact, and it has to be so scripted, so hardwired for yourself that when you deal with a talented terror, because again, they're verbally adroit, you know, they can be difficult, they're used to having really tough conversations and winning them. So you have to be prepared to deal with all of this stuff in a very upfront kind of fashion. And if you can do all of that, then generally life becomes significantly easier.
That sounds like advice you could use with teenagers, too.
You know, one of the funniest things is that I always recommend to leaders that if you're going to have a talented terror conversation, practice this at home. And if you have a teenager, make them role play the talented terror, because they do better at playing the talented terror than anybody who will ever work in your company. They role play it like nobody's business.
This is Chris Costello reporting for Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
I wish I had talked to you years ago. So, Mark, what is one thing that leaders today can do to really encourage this kind of 100% performance from their people?
One simple thing they can do is just sit down and ask people, hey, tell me about a time in the past couple of months where you got really excited and jazzed up, because you want to listen for what gets them excited. And then ask them, tell me one time in the past couple of months or month where you got really burnt out and demotivated. What was that? Because you want to know what demotivates them. You want to basically know what's the kind of work that you do that makes you act like a 100%er, and what's the times that get in your way that make you not act like a 100%er. And if you can just figure out those two things, it's the simplest conversation in the world. Have it over a cup of coffee, but they're going to tell you their own personal roadmap for becoming a 100%er.
Presentations are so important for so many people in business and many other arenas. What's one of the biggest myths about giving a presentation that you've seen people struggle with?
I would say one of the biggest issues that people struggle with is this idea that I've made my slide deck, I've made my presentation, and now I must go through every single slide in this presentation, and I can't stop. I can't interact with my audience, and come heck or high water, I must get through this thing, even if my audience is irritated and falling asleep. The great myth is that a presentation is a monologue. It's, I'm going to puke some stuff out to you, and I'm just going to talk for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or an hour or whatever, and hopefully you'll love it. The best presentations are oftentimes a dialogue. And it's so counterintuitive, and I wish more people did this, but presenters that do this have brilliant presentations. Rather than beginning with their kind of stock pitch, the best presenters will often, before they get into it, they'll say, listen, we got 30 minutes together today. What's one question that I can answer for you that would make the next 30 minutes a really great use of your time? What's one question that you want to make sure you know the answer to before you leave here today? And people will say, I don't want to use up the time in my presentation to get answers to that question because it's going to suck up so much time. And we'll often reply, well, okay, if you have 30 minutes to present, you got two choices. You could have 15 minutes of gathering information and then 15 minutes of giving a laser-focused presentation answering that one big question. Or you could speak for 30 minutes with no idea whether you're talking about the right stuff, just kind of puke it out there and hope that it meets the needs of your audience. The best presentations are the ones that answer the one question your audience has. Well, what's that question they have? And that's the thing I don't know. The only way to find that out is to ask them. And that's right there. And it goes back to, you know, we're talking about what's one thing a leader can do to help their employees become 100%ers. The irony of so much of leadership and presentation, they're very similar in this regard, that it's not so much what you say as it is the questions you ask. It's not so much having the answers as it is being able to ask the question. Because the people you need to help, whether it's an audience, whether it's an employee, they have the answers. What they don't often have is a leader who's willing to actually figure out what that answer is. That's the big kind of aha moment.
I'm so glad you said that, Mark. I've been to so many presentations where I wish they had started that way. So what is one of the questions that people ask you most often?
You know, it depends on what I'm talking about, but probably the most common question I think I get anymore is usually around this idea of, are leaders made or are they just born? And mostly it's because for so many years we've been taught that it's a function of, you know, great leaders are born, and that's just how it is. You're either a leader or you're not. And what we found overwhelmingly is that it's not generally the case. Are people born with certain tendencies and certain attributes that make them more predisposed to be able to lead effectively? Sure. Being a good listener, being interested in people, being a good communicator, being calm under pressure, those are all attributes that one can have in greater or lesser quantities. You see this in children. I see this in my own kids. They're very different personalities. But it doesn't mean that the core leadership behaviors can't be taught. And any one of us can learn to respect the people that work for us, to value their input, to set goals that are going to stimulate and challenge them, to build relationships with them. And those are all things that are eminently learnable and teachable. Again, can you be born naturally faster or slower? Sure, absolutely. But it doesn't mean that everybody isn't capable of going out and running a marathon. We all are. It's just how we apply ourselves. And that's the big issue.
So, Mark, what is the most costly mistake that you've seen salespeople doing when they give a presentation?
One of the biggies is, one, the presentation thing we talked about, but also along the lines of presentation, is when you think about a typical kind of sales presentation, most sales presentations have this slide right up front at the beginning that says, here's our company, and here's when we were founded, and let me tell you a bit about us, and this is where we came from, and we're the industry leader, and we've worked with XYZ clients, and blah, 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 blah. And they'll spend 5, 10, 15 minutes of the most valuable mental real estate in a presentation, which is the beginning, and they'll spend that time talking about themselves, as opposed to figuring out what the audience wants to hear. And that's the big issue we see over and over again. In fact, one of our basic rules for presentation is take that about us slide and just rip it out, delete it. Don't spend the first 10 to 15 minutes of your presentation talking about yourself. Spend that time discovering your audience's pain and then spend the rest of the time addressing that pain, but get rid of that slide that is the about us slide, because the people listening to you generally don't care. Most of the time, somebody who wants to buy something, let's say they want to buy a piece of software, they don't come into it and say, you know what, I don't care about the features of the software. What I really want to buy is a company that's been around for 56 years. No, I want to buy the thing that is going to solve my pain. Oh, Yahoo's been around longer than Google. Wonderful. Whose search engine is better? Oh, well, I like Google better. Okay, yeah, I'm going to go with Google. That's generally how people respond. I want to solve the pain that I have. I don't really care too much about how long you've been in business and how many clients you have. And so don't spend the first 15 minutes talking about yourself. Figure out what drives me, and then tell me how you can solve my pain. Because if you solve my pain, you know, nobody goes into their dentist when they have a cracked tooth and says, I'd like to see your credentials. No, they walk in and they say, please stop the pain in my tooth. Same thing applies.
That's even becoming more so with the internet age, right? I mean, I see that with my own children, where the youngest now, the loyalty factor is he doesn't care about the brand. He cares about the instant solving of a problem.
Exactly. What can you do for me? And, you know, don't put up the ad that tells me, you know, well, we've worked with 60% of the Fortune 500. No, I either am interested in what you're doing or I'm not. And you have about 30 seconds to make that pitch to me.
And so, Mark, what are some of the good tools that you have used to help people connect with their audience and that others can use?
There's a number of things that people can do. I will tell you, and this is going to sound incredibly strange, but oftentimes, a presenter, and this is a mark of an accomplished presenter, is that so often we get hung up on what's the latest technology. And certainly, you know, there are cool presentation tools out there. You know, you don't have to use always PowerPoint or even Keynote, which is the Apple product. You can use things like Prezi, Prezi.com. But the absolute kind of hallmark of a masterful presenter is when they pull up a flip chart and they give their presentation with some drawings on a flip chart. When a presenter is so fluent in their content that they don't need prompts from slides, that they can listen to the pain that their audience has and then spend the next 10 minutes, 15 minutes demonstrating with a flip chart and a conversation what their audience needs, those are some of the best presentations you'll ever see. Now, if you're selling software, will you want to demo the software, et cetera, et cetera? Yes, then those things can be useful. But it's the more conversational the tone, the more I feel like you're speaking to me as an individual, as opposed to giving me a canned script that could be used for anybody. That's the thing. If you pull out a flip chart, like, you know, the old-fashioned flip chart markers, you're delivering a presentation that is designed for me. It's created from scratch just for me. If you pull out a PowerPoint deck, you could have used that thing for 100 other people. And that's not for me. I don't feel special. But again, this all comes down to leadership and presenting is very much the same in that you are trying to connect with individuals. You're trying to make it feel like an individualized experience. And the more you do that, the more success you're going to have.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
And you have to be really careful with email these days, right? I like the personal emails, and you get to the bottom, and it says, this is a test.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you must have some people that you really consider presentation gods or mentors. Do you have anybody like that that you really just have captured the art of presentation, besides yourself, of course?
You know, they're the cliched ones. You know, certainly the late Steve Jobs gave masterful presentation. The sort of biggest quality he brought to it was an absolutely insane level of preparation and practice to his presentation. He's very remarkable in that regard. Howard Schultz at Starbucks is a highly effective presenter, and there's dozens of them. All of these sort of cliched leaders, you know, the Richard Branson, all of those guys tend to do a very, very good job. But what I found is that, you know, I've seen teachers, I've seen middle managers, I've seen salespeople, and they're all in their own way doing an exceptional job of just connecting with their audience. And we sometimes get too hung up on, you know, the Howard Schultz, the Steve Jobs, the Richard Branson, those types, because they're just oozing with charisma, magnetism, and everything else. But that's not always the mark of a great presentation. The mark of a great presentation is one that resonates with the audience. And there was a linguistic study done by a couple professors, I think at Yale, a number of years ago, looking at George W. Bush's language use over the course of his political career. So, you know, George W. Bush went to Andover, went to Yale, went to Harvard Business School, and early in his career, when he got destroyed running for Congress, he spoke like a guy who grew up in Nantucket and went to Andover, Yale, and Harvard. But he was getting destroyed running for Congress in Texas. So over the next few years, his language started to change, and we started to get strategery. We started to get words that weren't ain't, no, not, got, nothing, but, and we started to get all of that. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, he's the governor. And from a grammatical point of view, his language got atrocious. It resonated much more effectively with the audience he was speaking to, and gave him more of a quintessential Texas feel, if you will. So these professors charted his use of language and found that it really significantly changed over a 25-year period of his life. And it's the same thing. So you look at that and you go, well, you know, he used like three words that weren't words. Yeah, but he just got elected. So, you know, when we look at it, what's a great presenter, it's not always being the smoothest presenter. Sometimes it's just being the person who made the single best connection with the audience.
If someone is trying to connect with that audience, in your opinion, Mark, what is the single best way that you can plant a message that just stays in people's brains, that just they can't get rid of?
Sum up your presentation in less than 140 characters. Basically, what that means is have a headline. Make sure that your presentation has one single takeaway. You know, when Steve Jobs launched the iPhone, it was 1,000 songs in your pocket. When they launched the MacBook Air, it was the world's thinnest notebook. When Google was seeking money, their presentation was, Google provides access to the world's information in one click. Starbucks was starting up and looking for money. Starbucks creates a third place between work and home. Make sure that your presentation has one simple message that anybody can remember, and that'll be enough. If you do that, your audience is going to remember.
And how about creating stage charisma? One of the number one fears is public speaking.
Yeah, the single best thing you can do there, and any musician, any athlete will tell you this, is practice. There's a reason why Steve Jobs would prepare 8 hours of onstage time just for that 1 hour of presentation. It's because if it's burned into you, then all the nerves in the world, you're still going to be able to fall back on muscle memory and some basic retention.
And how important are stories in connecting with your audience?
You know, stories can be very important, and they help bring your core ideas to life. What I always tell presenters is, begin with your core message. Make sure that you understand the message, that it is crystal clear and poignant. And then once you've done that, now you can find stories that exemplify your particular message that you're trying to tell. The mistake that people often make with stories is that they'll begin with stories and say, I got a great story, and then they don't really have a particularly great message in there, so the message gets lost. But if they can focus on the core message and then use a story or two to bring that to life, then it becomes a very powerful teaching tool.
You know, I've been to a lot of presentations where they just kind of fade. And is there a way, Mark, that you can end a presentation that really changes what the audience gets from that?
Yeah, the big lesson is to write out your argument. Construct your argument on paper before you start putting slides together or anything like that. Construct your argument and, like, make a little tree. Here's point number one. Here's point number two. Here's what I'm going to say about this. Here's how I'm going to justify that. And once you've done that, then it becomes very easy to see, all right, I've just made my presentation. I've just made my argument. I've constructed it. But now I want to make sure that I just go back and recap what my core argument was. A reason a lot of presentations just kind of taper off is that people haven't really thought out their core argument. They haven't really thought out what is the point of what I'm saying here. And if you haven't thought that through, then it becomes very difficult to go back and remember to recap it. But if you've actually diagrammed your argument and you know exactly what the point is that you're trying to make, well, now all of a sudden it's not so terribly bad. It basically serves as a reminder, yeah, I need to go back and deliver this message and just sort of recap what it is I did and finish strong.
And with that, Mark, we want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And then I also would love it if you could share with our listeners a little bit about Leadership IQ. You've got a phenomenal website there with lots of different offerings. Just like it if you could tell us a little bit more about what you're offering on there.
Sure. Leadership IQ is basically a training company. We do a lot of research. We do a lot of things like employee surveys, employee engagement surveys, things like that. But we are fundamentally in the business of helping people become extraordinary leaders. And on our website, you can find our public webinars, which are webinars available for anybody to come and register for. There's our mega corporate clients and all of that. There's information on that. But we do have posted on the website at leadershipiq.com. We have a lot of our articles and white papers that we've just made available for the general public. So you can certainly go on there and register for free and check those out as well.
All right. Well, we want to thank you. And Mark Murphy's book, 100 Percenters, is available now. You can go to
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, any or all.
Terrific. That was incredible. Thank you so much, Mark.
That's the end of our interview. I hope you found it helpful. And for more great interviews on motivation, success, health, wellness, and marketing, go to my site, Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.